danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 188 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Catonsville, Maryland in the United States of America. I'm Andrew Brokus, joined by Nate Mavis.
Yes, from Cambridge, Massachusetts, also in the United States of America. How are you, Andrew?
I'm good. I'm, there's a bit of a letdown when WCOOP is over. In some sense, it's nice to not just have like all of my days consumed. I mean, it is the sort of thing where time goes by so quickly that, you know, I just left Montreal yesterday and I really didn't feel like I'd been there for 3.5 weeks. As I was leaving, I was like, really? I've been here? It just kind of the days just sort of go by, which isn't a great way to live, I guess. But there's also just the disappointment of like, it was nice being able to play online poker. And of course, anytime, you know, there's a big poker series and you don't win something, right? The poker series starts out with all this promise and potential ahead of you. And I had a fine series, really. I mean, I cashed quite a few tournaments. I had some runs that easily could have turned into something better than they were. I don't feel like I made a lot of really significant errors, and a lot of the times where I was going out of tournaments, it was situations that were basically unavoidable. So I don't really have a lot of regrets related to it, but it's just sort of like the potential was there and it didn't materialize this time around, and now it's gone. there's that sort of letdown.
Yep. And it's September 2016. Are the games dead?
They're certainly not dead. I was surprised in an unpleasant way at the higher stakes ones were definitely really noticeably tougher, and the fields were pretty small for some of like the $500 rebuy had a pretty small field. Was it a $700 one rebuy one add-on, or maybe $500? There was one that was like very close to having overlay. They just sort of, I mean, obviously like the poker players were paying attention and they weren't going to let it have overlay. People were buying in at the last minute, but it was, you know, they were not getting massive fields in some of these, you know, bigger buy-in weekday morning sort of events. And I will say a lot of the kind of like tournament regulars, I always sort of wonder like, or try to have a concrete answer to what is my edge on them, right? Obviously I don't have experience as an advantage over people who are just, you know, 10 tabling or more than that tabling MTTs 5, 6, 7 days a week, every day of the year. Even if they're 23 and I've been doing this for 10 years and they've been doing it for 5, they still at this point have probably played more tournaments than I have. So I don't have that experience on them. And I have, you know, generally said that I think there's a lot of things that I understand about game theory and about deep stacked play and just, you know, playing after the flop and playing turns and rivers that I never felt like tournament regulars were that good at. And I've been encountering more and more just sort of, from my perspective, generic Europeans, like not European players that I recognize their screen names as, you know, like obviously this person's a top player, like people I'd never heard of before who were handling those situations quite well. I saw a lot of like overbetting in the right types of situations. I saw a lot more, you know, barreling and appropriate blind defense, appropriate sizes of raises, appropriate flatting of 3 and 4 bets when people are getting good prices to do so. A lot of things that I remember even this time last year, which is the last time I played online, it still felt like a lot of the otherwise competent tournament regulars were making mistakes in these situations.
All right. So that's grim, but also interesting and exciting.
Now, I will say, like, I mean, there are a fair number of, like, weak players out there also. I noticed a lot more people from China. That was probably the biggest thing is I feel like it used to be very rare to see a player with China listed as location. And I was starting to see quite a lot of that. India also. Those were kind of the two biggest things. And it was rare to see one of the person with a China or India location playing well. So I think there's an introduction of a lot of inexperienced players from those areas. And, you know, it'll be similar. Like, it used to be that you were excited to see, like, Italian players at your table. And, you know, as the game has gotten more popular there, that's starting not to be the case anymore. So, you know, I'm not insinuating that, like, Chinese or Indian people are bad at poker, just that it's new in their market. And, over time, they probably will become more experienced. But I kind of got the sense that especially for like higher stakes people, I got the sense that was where a lot of the loosest money is coming from now, which I think makes sense.
Yeah. And there's also money in those places.
Right.
So you think poker might go the way of snooker, where, you know, the game's sort of drying up a little bit, but there's a lot of Chinese interest that might keep things afloat for a while?
Well, I had no idea that's a comparison to snooker, but yeah, I mean, I just like, you need to find new markets, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's good. The other thing that the Poker Stars, there was a very noticeable trend in the W Coup that if it does actually have the effect of, you know, drawing in more recreational players or keeping more recreational players playing, you know, could be a good thing, is there were a lot of bounty tournaments, or what PokerStars calls knockout tournaments. There were a lot of knockout tournaments, like even like the anti-up, which is, I really like the anti-up format, and I don't necessarily dislike knockouts, but they made the anti-up a knockout tournament. Just a lot of other tournaments that have been in WCOOP for a while, they added a knockout structure to it. And I think this is obviously related to what they've also done, like at EPT Barcelona. They were paying out, I think, 25% of fields. So, you know, they're making a push to flatten payout structures. And bounties are another way of doing that. Bounties are a way of having the prize pool distributed more flatly to, you know, small amounts of money going to a larger number of players, which I think from PokerStars' perspective is certainly good, because any money that's cashed out off of the site is bad for them. And so having more people with small amounts of money reduces the likelihood that it's going to be cashed out and makes it more likely that people are going to play it through. I think it has the potential to be good for professional players as well, if it is the sort of thing, I mean, similar to, you know, limit hold'em versus no limit hold'em, and the old thing about how casinos or card rooms didn't like to offer no limit because fish went broke too quickly. It might be the case that if knockout tournaments and flatter payout structures really do result in recreational players having a better time and ultimately losing more money, as long as PokerStars isn't capturing too high a share of that money with their rake, that could end up being a sort of win-win-win, where recreational players have more fun, professional poker players and PokerStars, who are sort of the service providers, make more money. I mean, that has the potential to be a win across the board if it actually works out that way.
Yep, I agree. I mean, it also could ruin the game, but
yeah, I mean, I gave the optimistic view since I was being so pessimistic before.
Yeah. No, but I think I've long, and I used to get into disagreements on 2+2 a lot about this when PokerStars took the scandalous step of paying 15%, and the World Series took this equally scandalous step of paying more than 10%. And people said that, oh, you know, first place would be higher if they hadn't paid so many. And I said, you know, be careful how you evaluate your counterfactuals, because, you know, would all the people who entered this tournament have entered this tournament if previous tournaments had not also paid more money? And people really like cashing. So I do think there's a sweet spot there. And I'm not sure it's 25%. That sounds pretty extreme. But one can be optimistic. And, you know, it's interesting times for poker. So,
and, you know, lower variance is a nice thing for tournament. And I'm not, you know, like I play a lot of cash game poker, which has quite low variance compared to tournament poker. And I think for a lot of the tournament pros, I mean, yeah, it in some sense, your expected value is higher in more top heavy payout structures, because you should be winning first place a lot more often than, you know, there are some recreational players who are like, they're not dead money to cash, but they're basically dead money to win a tournament.
Yeah.
At the same time, like, I think a lot of tournament players, poker people in general, really don't appreciate variance. And when you're talking about fields of, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of players, it will have some actual effect on your career. Like, experiencing lower variance really will flatten out some of the particularly ugly tail ends of certain curves that you could experience as a professional tournament player.
Yeah, that's right. And I also think that Some of people's instincts about this were formed during times when the environment was different, and some players who used to be mostly drawing dead to win are now almost completely drawing dead to win. I mean, this year, I think, in the November 9, people were surprised that there was one person who listed his favorite game as Baccarat. Like, I think if memory serves, there's one person, and I apologize if I'm wrong about this, but there's one pretty serious rec player among the November 9, and that's, if anything, high. And, you know, it just isn't how it used to be. And guy is probably a lot better than a lot of the field, you know, even though he's, you know, maybe sort of a gambler first and a poker player second, he's probably not in the bottom 8% of the field. And those people are just drawing very nearly dead to win. And that guy is, if he's not improving over this, you know, however many months, is drawing real, real, real slim to win or even to get second. So, I think giving these people a chance at, you know, quadrupling their money, is good and is a lot harder to do these days.
First off, big news from Tournament Poker Edge world. Instructor Jace Regina won the $100 multi-day W Coop event. This was one that had a crazy number of flight ones. So that was a three-day tournament. You could play the first day over. There were, I think you had maybe 35 different opportunities or something. So quite a large field. And Jace came out on top. And a membership at Tournament Poker Edge will get you access to lots of videos from Jace. And of course, since I was playing the W Coop, I'll have some W Coop content going up on Tournament Poker Edge soon, as I imagine many of the other instructors will as well. So this is a great time for you to sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com, and congratulations again, Jace. So strategy stuff today. First off, I thought since we don't have a guest, I thought it would be, you know, take the opportunity to discuss both a hand and also a somewhat more abstract question, because those can be interesting. So we got one from William that I thought was sort of neat. And he said, let's say you're at a table where there's a player more skilled than you, and they're sitting two seats to your right. And this player always button straddles your big blind. Couple questions here. First, as an amateur player, I would be more inclined to fold my big blind if I suspect that the button player is significantly better than me. Even with hands like King 9 suited that I might normally call a small raise with, even knowing that he is raising blind. Mostly this would be because I don't want to play a bloated pot at a position against a known skilled player. Is this a decent strategy, or am I just throwing a bunch of money away? I guess more precisely, am I losing more money by playing out of position or by throwing one big blind away every orbit? So let's stop here first, and we'll discuss that first question.
All right. So, you know, more tangible part first. I think folding King 9 suited is a good play if you have a very good player who is button straddling. If you were closing the action, or if you had all-in protection or something, then I would call. But you are not doing so, there's going to be a raise behind you. You're going to have to fold to a raise, and you suffer reverse implied odds. When you take a flop, all those things add up to King 9 suited being a fold, I think, if it goes button straddle, small blind call, or small blind fold, and you're in the big blind with, you know, halfway in with King 9 suited. Do you agree with that?
I don't think I would fold it.
Really? Good player button straddling? One more big blind? Yeah, I mean, it's a call for me in some usual environments, but against, if I know the player button straddling is good, I think especially because there's, I think, and this is a change in live games from 2 or 3 years ago, I think you see a raise more often than you used to. I think between not seeing a flop and not automatically getting to showdown when I flop a king and it's good, and you know, other things, I default to a fold there against a good player. Against a table of unknowns, it's a bit tougher. But maybe I'm too tight.
He's raising that wide that it's just like, is it that it's basically a lock to get raised? Then I mean, then you call. Like,
So, wait a minute. Are we thinking of the same situation? I'm thinking Mississippi Straddle.
Right.
And then you're in the big blind, and there are five or six other players, plus the button who's straddled, who can raise it.
Sure. Yeah, I think I would complete there. So, I mean, we're assuming also, because this can vary from card room to card room, but we're assuming that, like, the blinds have to act first because of the button straddle. So
yeah, that's right.
We're saying, small blind folds, and now it's on you, and you're going to complete, and then there's going to be a bunch of other players who get to act, and then the button will get to act.
Even if those players are only raising, you know, top 12% or maybe top 20% near the button, you're still going to be against, I mean, then what would you do with King 9 suited?
Sorry, say that again.
So let's say you have King 9 suited and you call in that spot, and then the next three players are all raising the top 10% of their hands, and the two players after that are raising the top 20% of their hands, and the button, if it folds to him, is raising the top 28% of his hands. How often are you going to be seeing the flop in that spot, do you think?
I think pretty often. I don't necessarily mind calling raises. I mean, it depends a bit on the size of it and whatnot, but, like, supposing it goes raise, call, button calls, I think calling it is very defensible. I think if it goes limp, button raises, I think calling or three betting with King 9 suited is very defensible. King 9 suited is a pretty good hand against wide ranges. I mean, stack sizes would be helpful to know here as well, but I'm assuming that we're, like, relatively deep. I guess the main situation is I don't want to end up, like, heads up against an early position raiser getting bad odds, and I don't want to end up and a three bet in front of me. Those are sort of the two situations where I would consider myself least likely to see a flop, is if it goes early position raise and no calls, or if it goes raise three bet.
That's interesting. So if you complete, cutoff makes it 45, you know, folds to the cutoff and makes it 45, and it's back to you, and, you know, say 100 big blind stacks, so $500 stacks. It's $35 more to you with the extra button straddle dead in the pot. Call, fold?
Yeah, I'm happy to call that.
Okay. Is that, would you consider that, like, a good spot? Would you rather call or get your $5 back and fold?
I think I'd rather call.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I guess I'm just a big old nit face here. So yeah, I do think if the button is particularly skilled, you're not losing a lot by folding. So how big a leak do you think my folding King 9 suited here is?
Yeah, I guess not that large. And I guess, part of it too is, like, I'm reasonably comfortable in a lot of the situations that are likely to come up. And I'm guessing that, you know, just kind of from the way this question is phrased, William maybe is not. I really encourage in general when people are sort of like, well, shouldn't I just avoid these situations? I really want to tell people, like, no, you should learn to play them. Yeah. Not that that's a trivial thing to do, and avoidance is a reasonable kind of, like, stopgap measure, but I just think a lot of people really underestimate, just in general, the sort of, like, oh, I'm just going to fold rather than have to, you know, potentially deal with a difficult situation later.
I very much agree with. I also think that King 9 in this spot benefits from the straddle, in the sense that shortens the effective stacks. So in the example I gave, if you call that hypothetical cutoff raise, then there's 90, 100, let's say $97 after rake in the pot going to the flop. So the SPR is like 4.5. So that really cuts down on some of the bad things that can happen with King 9 suited. But
I wanted to bring that up too, because William says, you know, he mentions, I don't want to play a bloated pot out of position, but really the bloated is in your interest. Like, as long as the ranges are still somewhat narrow, which I think they are, sorry, not narrow. As long as his range is, like, sufficiently wide, which if we're talking about, like, you know, cutoff or button raise, it should be, or the odds you're getting are sufficiently good, which if it's, you know, early position raise and a couple of calls, it will be. The fact that it's bloated really should be to your advantage playing out of position, and also being a less skilled player.
Yeah. And I think more generally, I mean, we've already gotten into the theory side of this, but being out of position is bad. There's a reason that you fold a lot of blinds generally, even though you're partway in. It's that, you know, there's a disadvantage to being out of position. And, you know, the button straddle is good for some people and bad for others. It probably benefits the cutoff. It probably benefits the player to his right. And maybe it's bad for the blinds. It's, you know, arguably it takes some equity away from you, especially because it forces you to act first. And, you know, I, not always, but often button straddle. I think it's a winning play at a lot of tables, and I think, you know, there are winners and losers to it. You get a chance to do it the same way other people do, and learning how to react to it is more important than fretting that you're throwing away one big blind every time around the table. Which, I mean, blinds are supposed to make you put in money in disadvantageous circumstances. You know, everybody else has to do that also.
So, and this kind of brings us around to William's second question, which is that if a seat were to open a few seats to the right of the skilled player, would it be beneficial to move there? I.e., would I lose more money by throwing away one big blind per orbit or by being on his right? In other words, you know, having this player in position on you when you have, for instance, the hijack, you know, you're going to have this player, he's going to be on the button, and that's going to significantly reduce the value of your hijack. And I guess also reduce the value of your button when he's the one in the big blind. He's going to do a better job of defending that than many people will. I think this depends a lot on how deep you are and on whether other players are also button straddling. Because as you said, I think you're right, Nate, that especially in a format where the button straddle forces the blinds to go first, and I have played some places where it does not, so the action starts under the gun. And as long as nobody raises, then the button gets to go last. But if somebody does raise, then the button acts in turn. But if the button straddle forces the blinds to act first, then... I do think it's pretty bad for you as the big blind to have the button straddling. So the other thing that's relevant here, that I think maybe even more important, is how deep we are. The deeper we are, the more of a concern I think being consistently out of position against the stronger player is. So the two factors would be how deep are we, and also are other players straddling also, or does moving seats mean that your big blind is not going to get straddled anymore? And I guess if it is exactly two seats to his right, such that you're going to be able to straddle his big blind, that'll be pretty nice for you. So if it's like exactly two seats to his right and my big blind isn't going to be getting straddled anymore, yeah, I'd be pretty tempted to do that.
Yeah, that seems right. I would worry more about where the big stacks are and where the big stacks with a lot of money are and so on. So I think usually other factors are going to be a little bit more important than the button straddling part of it. But it is a relevant thing to consider when you're thinking about whether to change seats.
All right. Well, thanks very much, William. I thought that was an interesting question. And yeah, I imagine it is something that comes up for a fair number of cash players. And you don't find a lot of discussion of like button straddling strategy in poker books and that kind of thing. So yeah, I think it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah.
Sorry, were you going to say something?
No, I was just going to agree with you.
Okay. Also have a more traditional strategy hand coming to us from Ray. And Ray says this hand came up during event 56 of the World Series of Poker. The villain is a cash game player from New York, but now lives in Las Vegas. He plays frequently and is not afraid to fire a turn bet after betting a flop. He has accumulated the biggest stack at the table, but in the last hour has been a bit spewy, paying off in hands in marginal spots. He would also flat with a wide range of suited hands from position. Hero, I am in the two seat and will be the effective stack at about 21k, 35 big blinds. Earlier in the day, I played one hand very passively against him, raising pre-flop and then check-folding a no-equity flop. I have been less volatile than most other players, preferring to build my stack slowly. The hand in question, blinds 300, 600, 75, folds to me, our hero, under the gun plus one, and I look down at pocket aces. I take my time and raise to 1500. Folds around to the villain, who flats on the button. The blinds fold. The pot is about 4,500 with antes. And Ray says this is what he's thinking about the villain's range so far. Wide, in capital letters. He might not be doing this with any two suited, but I certainly expect to see any pair below jacks, any suited connector, perhaps even 2-3, maybe even a good number of suited one-gappers. He won a big hand with 9-7 suited in a similar spot earlier in the day, and any two Broadway. First question is, do we agree? Which is a little tricky for us to answer because obviously we don't know who this player is. I don't agree that that's what his reign should look like, but it might be what it does look like.
Yeah, there are a lot of people like that who they think that they have a big stack. They think that they're in the early levels, and if they look down at 6-4 suited, they're not going to fold it. It's just not going to happen. Whether this is one of those people, I wasn't there. He was. So the only real answer is I don't know. But there are certainly a lot of folks who roughly fit this description running around the World Series. And so I don't doubt it. How about that?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of folks who fit that description. My concern is that it's also easy, like just looking at kind of some of the reasoning that Ray gives for why he comes to that conclusion. Like he says he saw this player call with 9-7 suit in a similar spot earlier in the day. I mean, earlier in the day could have meant that, you know, the effective stack was two or three times as deep as it is now, yeah, which would, you know, make it a lot more defensible for the villain to be calling with some of the hands that we mentioned. So there's a few hands in that range that seem particularly dicey to me. Some of the weaker suited one gappers and, you know, the weaker suited connectors, even like 2-3 suited. I don't think 5-4 suited is a particularly good call in this spot. 9-7 suited seems borderline, but maybe okay. Like 7-5 suited is not good. And then like, you know, any two Broadway, I mean, Jack 10 offsuit, I think is a pretty abysmal call for the button in this spot. And again, it's not to say that this player isn't doing that, but I think it can be dangerous to extrapolate from, you know, he seems to be playing a lot of hands and has earlier in the day called raises with, you know, various suited hands when in position, when in fact the stacks are much deeper than they are now, to extrapolate from that and say, you know, therefore he's calling extremely wide in this exact situation.
Yeah, so that's great. I really want to emphasize all that. And one big mistake people make is really overgeneralizing from maybe one bad call or maybe something that looks aggressive, which can often be just something that you don't understand. Like maybe there's prior history between these people. Maybe it's just like one play that he's got in his arsenal. People make that mistake against me a lot, is seeing one or two things I do and thinking I'm much more aggressive than I am. That said, this is live poker. This is not internet poker. And a lot of people who play too many hands and call too many early position raises are doing it because they can't help themselves. And people who have zero self-control manifest that in a lot of ways, both poker ways and non-poker ways. So, you know, the things that they're saying, the other things they're doing, the hands that they're raising with, and not just the hands that they're calling with, and just the things, you know, that people are doing. You're not going to be able to, on purely sort of statistical grounds, inferring from somebody's play, figure out that they're probably calling with three deuce suited in that spot at the table. But it's a lot easier to figure out that somebody's just an emotional infant. And if you also figure out that somebody's way of manifesting emotional infancy or extremely fragile masculinity or whatever is to call with way too many hands, then you can be pretty justified in thinking that he's doing this. So, yeah. So sometimes these inferences are bad. Sometimes they're really good. And again, I wasn't there.
All right. So we're heads up to the flop, which is King Jack 10 Rainbow. Ray says, I pause to think about what to do here. I briefly consider checking. Villain would bet 95% of the time if I did. I decided I would rather retain control of the betting and fired out a c-bet of 1500. I had not decided yet how big of a pot I wanted to play. Comments?
Whoa. So you have aces. The other person's going to bet 95% of his range, and he called with everything if you check. Like, man, unless he's going to get really spewy against a bet, I think that means you have to check. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that would be true. I think that the villain will bet 95% of the time if I check. Yeah, sounds like another one of the difficult to agree with assumptions.
Yeah.
Which again, I don't know who the player is. There's a chance this is true, but I think it's more likely that Ray is misestimating what's going to happen here.
Yeah, by a mile probably.
Just because a player is aggressive doesn't mean that they're going to bet like certain hands that really would not be good hands to bet on this flop.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of hands that you would like him to bet that he may not bet, that he might, you know, attempt to pot control, for instance, ace jack comes to mind, or ace 10 or queen 10. I just think there's a lot of hands that, like, just because he's aggressive doesn't mean he's going to bet like those exact hands.
Yeah. I also want to talk about keeping control of the betting. As with everything else, you have to ask yourself, what do you mean by having control of the betting? And is that a good thing? I don't, you know, one of the smartest people I ever played poker with, you know, I used to say, you know, there are situations in PLO where I'd rather be out of position than in position. And of course, everybody thought that he was the worst player alive. He wasn't. He was brilliant. Similarly, what do you mean by having control of the betting? Like, you know, the person's calls or future bets will be very interpretable. Well, is that because you narrowed his range so much that you took a lot of the bad hands that he would have bet out of it? That's not good. What exactly do you mean by having control of the betting, and do you want to have control of the betting? If the person is just firing away with everything, yes, you have a worse idea of what he has when he bets, but that's you know, that, and that has some costs, but it has the much greater benefit of him shoveling money into the pot, drawing nearly stone dead. So as with all things, not that our correspondent is doing this, but, you know, control the betting, it's a bit of a fixed phrase. It's something that people use as a heuristic, and we should try to do better than that.
Yeah, and it's not true, really. Like, he's allowed to raise. I mean, you can't set your own price by betting. I mean, I guess to some extent, like, I guess there is a certain type of opponent who's sort of very passive facing bets, and you do see this kind of player at like 1-2 and 2-5 tables, who just like will very rarely raise, but will bet a lot and win check too. And so I guess like against a player making exactly that sort of mistake, like the idea of I can control the betting by making a bet myself and then my opponent probably won't raise me. I mean, that is kind of a thing that happens in certain types of games, but it's definitely not a fixed feature of the game. Like, if this villain has ace queen or pocket jacks or something, he can raise the flop. So, you know, you don't get to say, well, if I bet 1500, that means I'm deciding that only 1500 will go into the pot on the flop, particularly if I'm out of position. I mean, if you're in position, you can control the betting in the sense that you can check and ensure that there no bet goes into the pot on the flop. But from out of position, you know, controlling the betting is not really a tool that's available to you, I think, in the sense that a lot of people sort of assume that it is.
Yeah. And I mean, even if this person likes to get fancy, if he has, let's say, 8-7 offsuit and he peeled real wide with it before the flop, flop comes king jack 10, you bet. Is he really going to float or raise against an early position raiser? Some people will, but a lot of people are just going to try to find another spot to mess with you, because especially if this person isn't completely broke yet, he can see that this board hits an early position raiser, and he entered the tournament, so he's not completely broke yet. Maybe he will be soon, I don't know. But yeah, I just think if he's going to fire away at this board, and some people will, you know, they'll think that you have pocket eights if you check, or ace jack that they can two barrel or something. Then I think checking is a lot better. But again, I do doubt that he's betting 95%.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of whether we should bet or check, I think it's probably pretty close. And I think if we were to put it into some sort of, you know, solver, it would probably be a mix of betting and checking, you know, against a real live opponent, given the assumptions, even if the assumptions are a little bit off that Ray is making. Checking and calling still sounds pretty appealing to me if we think this guy's going to be pretty bluffy, because betting and getting raised is not appealing to me. So if his aggression will manifest itself as a raise on the flop, I'm going to feel a lot more comfortable checking and calling bets than I am going to be betting and calling raises.
Yeah, and if this guy is thinking checking and calling, that leaves a lot of barrelable stuff in your range. Like, especially if he thinks that you're a little bit scared, like you're going to have a lot of ace king, king queen, maybe, you know, pocket queens that might hit a bad run out, you know, maybe ace jack that. You know, in his eyes, you checked and called with. There's a lot of stuff that he could either make a call. Well, yeah, it's more complicated, but you're not representing overwhelming strength by checking and calling, which I think is nice.
Yeah. Our hero, as we said, bets 1,500. Villain raises to 4,500, and Ray says, "I start narrowing his range fast. I spend a small amount of time thinking about what he might have. Based on the raise, I tend to think he has a queen, but not ace-queen, as I have two blockers." That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So it's true that you do have blockers to ace-queen. That does not prevent your opponent from having ace-queen. It cuts in half the likelihood that he has ace-queen. But if he started with 16 combinations of ace-queen in his range and then you have two aces, there are still eight combinations out there. It's still, for instance, much easier for him to have ace-queen than it is for him to have a set. So we definitely can't take ace-queen out of his range entirely. In fact, I think ace-queen is a hand that he would very plausibly, like, I see no reason why he wouldn't play all eight combinations of ace-queen this way.
Yeah, I mean, especially thinking about preflop, I mean, a lot of these people are just not going to 3-bet ace-queen in the spot for very good reason. And, yeah, so, you know, not only given that he got to the flop this way, he would raise them a lot, and I think that's pretty plausible. But those are all, I think, just 100% in his preflop range to play that way, or if nothing's 100%, over 90%.
Yeah, and I think also the like, I don't see why a raise has to indicate that he has a queen. In fact, I think queen hands with a queen in them would not want to raise. Like, king-queen, jack-queen, ten-queen, pocket-queens. None of those are hands that I think would be real excited to raise
here. Queen-jack suited.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think the raise is likely to represent something much more polarized, where which is why I say I don't really want to get raised after betting. I think the raise is unlikely to represent hands that we have great equity against, the kind of hands that we were really hoping that he had when we saw the swap. I think the raise is more likely to represent either a bluff or a hand that has us in pretty bad shape, whether that's a set or, I guess, top two pair equity isn't so bad against. But, yeah, straight sets, bluffs and two pairs, I guess, are, it's kind of the hands I would expect to raise the flop most often.
Yeah, I think that's right. If he has three tens, I don't see why he's not raising. I mean, there are some reasons to call, but I think there are a lot of hands that don't have queens in them that will raise here. Given that, I think if this person's going to play well on later streets, folding's not terrible, I don't think. It wouldn't be my default. But against some people, I would fold right away and feel pretty happy about it. I think calling is a fine default thing to do. I don't see really any reason to 3-bet.
No, I agree. No reason to 3-bet. And I think it's somewhat close between folding now or calling and check folding a lot of turns.
Yeah.
And yeah, in that case, we're sort of hoping that he either was raising with two pair and then won't bet the turn, and we can... because getting to see two cards against two pairs is pretty nice, and I think we have the equity to do that. And if he's going to give up with some bluffs after raising the flop and we don't go away, then, again, there's value in calling the flop and then just trying to check it down after that.
Yeah.
If we think he's always going to fire the turn, then we probably do well to just fold now.
Yeah, that's right. And also, like, not only can other good things happen if we call, but, you know, hitting a queen is allowed. Hitting an ace is not perfect, but not bad either. A 10 is not so bad. A king is maybe not going to promote us to the best hand all that often, but might define his range a little bit more if he bets more. So there are good things that can happen on the turn. Not that that's a reason to call in itself, but if the decision is very close, otherwise, it's useful. One thing I, as a player, forget too often, how about that? A mistake I make is that it's not impossible to improve this hand. It feels impossible to improve sometimes, but it is not, in fact, impossible to improve your hand here.
No, that's true. The problem is just that your implied odds aren't very good, or sort of your equity realization isn't very good even when you do improve.
That's why I rounded off to zero. I'm just saying you shouldn't round it off to zero.
Okay, well, Ray does call. And we go to the turn with 13,500 in the pot. The turn is a rainbow deuce, so still no flush draw on the board. King, jack, 10, deuce. And Ray says, "I decide that I want to verify my ranges by not betting. Let me explain. I'm expecting that if he has solid showdown value, he will check back. My logic is that he can't know that I don't have ace-queen and that I just flop the nuts. I certainly would play ace-queen just like this up to this point and would sometimes check ace-queen here to induce a bet." I think that That's fair. I agree that this is a reasonable way to play ace queen. I think three betting the flop would be a reasonable way to play it also. I don't think that means that the villain has to check the turn. Like, it's not like he can never bet because of the possibility that you have ace queen. He's still allowed to bet and probably will and should bet sets and perhaps even top two pair. And just accept that sometimes he's going to run into ace queen. I do think that checking is much better than betting here, but I don't think it is really because of, you know, information that we're going to get from the opponent's check so much as I just don't think we have very much equity right now, and we don't want to be putting more money into the pot would be my main reason for checking.
Yep, I agree with all that.
So Ray does check, and Villain makes a bet of 7,500. Ray says, "I tried not to look too surprised, but I was."
We already covered this, but... It's not that surprising.
And Ray does go on. He says, "I expected it. He was used to being the one applying pressure based on his play style all day. When he bets here, I feel he must have a queen, and thus I could narrow his range to four hands. King-queen, queen-jack, queen-ten, or queen-nine. I have about 17.5 behind, and the pot is 21K. And he says, do you agree? I think we've sort of already covered this bit about he has to have a queen to be betting. And I guess I don't have a lot to add to what I already said about not liking that logic when we were talking about the flop raise.
Yeah, but I think it's worth saying that, you know, some of those hands would still keep on firing on the turn. The turn is not the same street as the flop. I think that this is... You know, for a lot of the same reasons, but not exactly the same reasons, there are going to be a lot of hands that don't have a queen that are betting and a lot of hands that do have a queen that are not betting here. I should say we're disagreeing with lots and lots of things that Ray is saying, but he is, making a lot of the right plays. That's good, I think. And he's also trying to read his opponent's hand and trying to, you know, condition that on his overall play and play style. And that's all to his credit. And he's doing a lot more hand reading than a lot of his opponents do. And rather than just disagreeing with a lot of things that he's saying, I think we ought to praise him for that, too.
Yeah, that said, there's something else I want to disagree with.
See, this is, aren't you glad we praised him already?
I think he says generally like the villain is used to applying pressure. And what that means to me is just that he could be bluffing here. I don't think it follows from that, you know, he's going to be betting a hand like king, queen, or queen, jack. I think those are like particularly poor hands for the villain to bet here.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that they're poor is that, you know, not all hands want to apply pressure. There are two kinds of hands that benefit from applying pressure. You know, very strong hands benefit, it's not exactly applying pressure, but they benefit from building a pot and giving your opponent a decision when he has a bluff catcher. And the reason why your opponent has incentive to put money in the pot with bluff catchers is that you could also be bluffing, and bluffs certainly benefit from applying pressure. Hands that are unlikely to win unless you fold are hands that do want to apply pressure for you. So, I mean, there are reasons why an aggressive player should play very strong hands aggressively and very weak hands aggressively. There are not necessarily reasons why you should play a hand like king queen aggressively. I guess this one exact hand is a potentially better hand that might fold to a bet, maybe ace king also, but in general, you know, king queen does not want to get check raised here. Getting check raised is a pretty big disaster for king queen here. King queen is not likely to be ahead of calling range here. So for king queen to bet, it's sort of like, it's not really a bluff because not very many better hands are folding, and it's not a value bet because worse hands aren't calling. So there's really not a lot of reason why king queen should be thinking in terms of applying pressure. And I think this again comes down to that, just kind of generically saying like, well, he's an aggressive player, therefore he would play any hand aggressively.
Yeah.
And I think that it's not really an extrapolation that follows.
Yeah. And also psychologically, a lot of the people who are most likely to bluff are also the most likely to understand this leverage stuff and are kind of least likely to throw money into the pot without thinking with a hand like king queen. So I think that, you know, not only from a theory point of view, but also from a psychological point of view, it's not super great to be inferring that he's just going to be applying pressure with, you know, a hand like queen jack or king queen.
Ray says, "I found it hard to release this hand here. In hindsight, I see that I could have waited queen nine stronger, but I still wasn't a believer. As I sit there, thoughts swirling in my head about playing with 17K left, all I can think is why isn't Dylan afraid of ace queen? I'm trying hard to play versus the four or so hands I think he can now have versus trying to guess an exact hand, and I can't get the lack of concern from Villain out of my mind. After about a minute in the tank, I shove and he calls and tables King Jack suited. But the river is a second two and I rake a huge pot. I can't help but say to the table, how do I not put him on King Queen there? A rake in seat one says, I thought he had you beat. So I can't assume that I didn't just get donk lucky. I guess we've sort of covered that already. But I think it's good that you're trying to put him on a range rather than on a specific hand. But I think you're still kind of narrowing it too much to say, you know, he has to have a queen. I think it's still pretty close to putting him on an exact hand. And I think that, you know, obviously, as I've said, like, I think pulling ace queen out of his range just because you're holding two aces, I mean, again, it reduces the possibility of him having it, but it certainly doesn't make it impossible.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's still going to be more combinations of ace queen than queen jack suited out there. Now, if he's calling with queen jack offsuit, that starts to change. But I think there's a number of reasons why he wouldn't show up with queen jack offsuit here.
I agree. So I have another thing to praise and another thing to not praise. So the thing to praise is that Ray wrote to us saying that he thought that the other guy probably had to have a queen, even though in the actual hand, which was very memorable for him, the person didn't have a queen, which means that all this stuff about the villain read is a little bit less likely to be just some elaborate post hoc justification or somebody pretending to know things just based on the way things went. Like, you know, we get some emails that are like, well, you know, for this elaborate reason, I knew he either had to be bluffing or he had exactly King Jack. And then it turns out he has King Jack. And sometimes that's right, but oftentimes no is being used incorrectly. Right. So hooray for that. Less great is not shutting up after you win that pot. So, like, if you say that you think the other person could have king, queen there, I think you're giving away a lot about how you think about poker, and I would be, if I were your opponent, really, really happy that you said that, just because a lot of people, especially a lot of people who would go broke with aces here, or get all the money in with aces the way you did here, would not think it's possible that the villain had king queen. A lot of people like that would think that king queen would be a pot controlling hand. So you're really giving away some information. There's also a chance that you're just nervous or excited that you won a big pot and you just can't help but talk. And there are things that those players do in World Series events that are really easy to take advantage of. And it's better not to suggest to the table that you are somebody who is, you know, a little bit tilty, you know, sort of has some winner's tilt or is a little bit overexcited to be winning a pot. So again, doing a lot of things really well, still disagree with some of the reasoning and some of the decisions.
I think that's a very good point. You know, the information, and you probably don't even realize it with some of these comments because they seem very sort of neutral.
Yeah.
They really are giving away a lot to people who know what to look for. And I really try to make this point every year around World Series time, just like you don't appreciate how much your casual conversation is giving away to some of the sharkier people at the table. And you really are doing yourself a big, now if you enjoy it, fine. I understand there are people who go because they really love poker and they just, it's more fun for them if they talk, and that's fine. Like if that's why you're there and you're primarily interested in kind of heightening your fun by talking about hands as they're going on at the table and engaging in all the sort of like poker banter, more power to you. It's your $10,000. But if you're, you know, really interested in maximizing your expected value in the tournament, just stop talking. Yeah. Even this stuff that you're saying that doesn't seem like a big deal to you is really telling a lot about how you think and how you're likely to play in the future.
Yeah. And again, for all I know, like, so I want to say I'm not saying anything about Ray here, but I think it's telling that earlier in the hand I was saying things like, look, there's a lot that you can tell about these players who might be calling way too much that you can't get just from the play of their hands. For example, some of them tattoo it on their forehead that they have really fragile masculinity, right? And it's that kind of comment that sometimes, and again, this is not Ray, but other people who say things like that, it's because they just can't stand for people to laugh at them or just can't stand for the people around them at the table to think that, you know, they're a bad player or a bad poker player who just got lucky at the time. And that has really significant hand reading consequences later. And indeed, you know, this is something that came up earlier in this very hand as an example of a live poker inference that people like me make a lot.
Thanks for writing, Ray. Hopefully you found that helpful. Sorry if I was tough on you. I do it out of love.
Yeah. No, and again, a lot of great stuff there, and all the masculinity stuff. That's really, really not about Ray. That's about certain specific people I played with this summer. But that's a different story.